Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, global alarm around COVID-19, also known as the new coronavirus. How did it begin? How dangerous is it? What needs to be done now to protect public health? With us is Paul Hunter. He's a professor of health protection at the Norwich School of Medicine at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's the author of Can Economic Indicators Predict Infectious Disease Spread? A cross-country panel analysis of 13 European countries, and also Misinformation Making a Disease Outbreak Worse, Outcomes Compared for Influenza, Monkeypox, and Norovirus.
So welcome to the Scholar Circle. Paul Hunter, it is great to have you here with us.
It's a pleasure.
I thought we should start perhaps at the beginning of this. Can we understand what exactly happened with this virus called both coronavirus and COVID-19 from its origins to now?
Well, we are pretty sure how it started. The virus itself comes it's one of many coronaviruses that are circulating in different bat populations. And so the virus that is now causing such a problem in the world originally came from a bat. It probably didn't jump straight from the bat into humans. It probably infected another mammal first. Possibly whilst that mammal, and maybe the bat as well, was being transported illegally into China. For sale in the markets. And the stress of transporting these animals is such that the animals get very stressed and they are more susceptible to the virus. So probably the intermediate host, the other mammal, got really quite poorly and the virus increased to large numbers. And then while it was being slaughtered or butchered in China, it infected a number of people.
Well, that would give us sort of an indication that there are more of these possible to get.
Oh, absolutely. There are a large number of coronaviruses in bats, and I'm sure all of them are queuing up to have their day in the sun in the human population.
I wonder then if we might need to distinguish this particular one from others that we, you know, that we face regularly. As you said, there are many coronaviruses. I understand some of them are not really dangerous at all.
Right. Yeah. Yes. They tend to be two different genera of coronaviruses. There are alpha coronaviruses, which are pretty much the ones that cause the common cold, that have been circulating in amongst human populations for ever and don't really cause that much harm other than, you know, a bad cold. And then there's the beta coronaviruses, of which there are three types. There's SARS, which came out in 2002-2003. There's MERS, which is Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus, which has been around since about 2012 and still occasionally causes infections, but not anywhere near the same frequency as SARS and especially COVID-19. And now we've got COVID-19. COVID-19 is closest to SARS virus than it is to the MERS virus.
So did we learn enough from MERS and SARS in terms of how to manage human populations that we can understand what needs to happen with COVID-19?
Right. I would have been a lot more positive about answering that question a month ago, when pretty much we thought it was going to follow the same sort of trajectory as SARS and behave quite like SARS. Although perhaps given that the many more cases we were seeing at the time, we should have been a little bit more prompt in realizing that it wasn't behaving quite like SARS. Certainly, we know a lot from SARS about how these sorts of viruses are spread from person to person, essentially by droplet spread, which is sort of when people cough or sneeze and they're close to you, or that coughs and sneezes lands on work surfaces that you then touch and put in your mouth. And so, yes, we know that from SARS. The differences, however, are some of them are quite striking. One is that it's not as severe an illness as SARS, and it seems to take longer. A lot more people have very mild symptoms compared to SARS. 80% of people that we know about have very mild illness, and there's undoubtedly a large number of cases of people who are infected that we don't know about, that probably either have no symptoms whatsoever or have such a mild illness that they don't bother seeking healthcare.
So that would give an indication that it could be like a more mild virus, except for people who might be compromised or whose immune systems can't.
Yes, yes. I mean, in general, the people who get the severe disease and indeed the people who die are people who are over 65 or have some other disease, diabetes, cancer, chronic lung disease. But that doesn't mean to say that otherwise healthy younger people don't get severe disease. We saw the sad case of the Chinese ophthalmologist who I believe was in his early 30s when he died. But we think that possibly he was particularly severe because he'd had such a high exposure to a lot of patients with the infection. And of course, if you're an ophthalmologist, you really get in your patients' faces in a way that other doctors don't, perhaps.
So repeated exposure might make somebody more vulnerable.
Possibly, yes. If it's over a short period of time and they have a very high exposure rate, that's certainly possible. I think it's more to do with the amount of virus that you take in rather than, you know, the frequency of it.
It also makes me wonder, separate from these new viruses or extensions of variations of viruses, it makes me wonder also about these superbugs that are antibiotic resistant and why some people are able to fight them and other people are not able to fight them, because they've said similar things. For example, with MRSA, you know, people who have that can normally be carriers and go on with their lives and be fine, but other people cannot fight it.
Yeah, it's not quite the same, because with these antimicrobial resistant organisms, what we can become colonized with them, and many of us are colonized, and they can sit there quite happily until we have an injury or some surgery or whatever, that actually they then infect the wound, and you then try antibiotics, and the antibiotics fail. So it's not quite the same, but you're quite right. I mean, the vast majority of us who would pick up an antibiotic resistant organism would have no problems. Perhaps never. Perhaps no problems for a year or so, but perhaps if we then say developed a urinary tract infection a year later, we might actually get the infection with that same organism.
So there's been a lot of talk around containment with the virus, mm-hmm. with COVID-19.
Yes.
Just to go back to that, whether or not it can be contained. And you had said, I think in another interview, that you'd sort of lost faith in that possibility. What does that mean?
Well, I don't think I've lost faith in it. I think I think we're getting beyond the point that may no longer be sufficient. When you've got small numbers of cases, you can go to quite extraordinary lengths to isolate them so that they don't spread the infection. You can nurse them in special high consequence infectious disease units so that you can be really sure that the people nursing them know how to prevent infections, keep themselves safe, and make sure that that patient doesn't spread the infection to anybody else. That only works when you've got relatively small numbers of cases, because I don't know off the top of my head how many of these beds we have in the UK, but it can't be many more than 20 or 30 or something like that. If you had a couple of hundred cases, then we wouldn't be able to use those sort of beds. We'd have run out of them, and so we'd have to move to different strategies for protecting people. But if And when we start seeing the infection spreading within the community, the wider community, then just isolating people that are infectious, that are ill, and that you know is positive, you're going to miss so many, and it will no longer really be an effective way of controlling the spread. And in fact, once it is spreading like that in the community, there's very little that you can do to stop the overall epidemic spread. And then you change your strategy from containment of cases to a more protective containment, where you try and actually keep particularly vulnerable people away from risk. So, for example, you might, in that context, wish to stop people visiting nursing homes and for the elderly care and that sort of thing.
And then, of course, there's the possibility of a vaccine being developed. I understand there is something being developed. Do you know about this?
Yeah, well, as I understand it, there are four decent vaccine candidates that are all pretty much close to being used in clinical trials. The problem with the vaccine is that it's these days it's actually very easy to make one, and we've got coronavirus vaccines already that for SARS we've never had to use them, but we've got a vaccine that seems to be effective for SARS. But with a new vaccine, you've first got to produce it, which is these days is the easy part. You've then got to prove that it's safe in people, that you don't give it to people and they then start getting other illnesses or particularly severe reactions to it. So you have to prove it's safe. And then you have to prove it's effective in terms of generating the immunity that you want. All that takes time. So at the very earliest that we will have a vaccine is probably the end of this year, but more likely into early next year.
Is it possible at all that people who do get exposed but don't have the symptoms are actually developing the immune system already?
Yes, the immunity to the virus. Oh, absolutely. I think if you get the infection and you don't get ill, it's because to a large extent you've developed an immunity to it. And so, yes, the big question, though, with these people is whether they're infectious to others. And there's some evidence that they possibly are, but other evidence has contradicted that. So certainly, again, about a month ago, I would have said that, you know, that these people are probably not infectious, but I'm less confident now. But that doesn't mean to say that I think that's a major source of that they are a major source of transmission, but you know, you don't need them to be that. You just need, you know, one or two people causing an infection in a population that's not been exposed to it so far, and then they develop the illness.
So that would also then pertain to people who need to travel in an enclosed airplane. Explain that to us.
Certainly with SARS, we were aware with SARS that there was a number of episodes where people were infected whilst they were travelling. And there was one particular super spreader event associated with an aeroplane where the person spread the infection around several people on board. Now, the view is that if you are infectious with this virus, then you would probably only spread it to people sitting in the row in front of you and the row in front of them and possibly the people in the two rows behind. And that is, and given how we know that the disease is spread, that is by droplets, that is probably a reasonably good estimate, really. The problem is that in that one of those outbreaks, people got infected in several parts of the plane. And other people have argued about this. Some have said, well, you know, we don't know for certain that they'd got their infection on the plane. Maybe they'd got the infection somewhere else, etc. So we can't But other people, and I actually tend to, I tend to believe this particular explanation. I think some of those people that weren't actually sitting close to the index case were probably maybe stood next to him in the queue waiting to board aeroplanes, because I'm sure you've taken quite a few air flights in your career, and you do tend to stand around in a crowd waiting to board the aeroplane for sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes longer, and which is a time that you might actually then be spreading the infection.
So there's also been a suggestion that warmer weather will help tamp down the virus.
Yeah. Well, we don't know this for certain, because clearly, you know, it's only been going since December. But when you look at other infections, particularly influenza, that are spread in roughly the same way, influenza tends to cause problems in winter. In the Northern Hemisphere, it's November, December, January, February, March. And the rest of the year, you still see the occasional case, but it's of influenza, but it's substantially less frequent. You know, it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. In SARS, what happened was that we had it, it lasted 8 months and then sort of disappeared in August. So it came at around about the same time and then disappeared. It's in my view, not random that actually even now it was December that this virus seemed to start causing problems. And I expect it to decline as summer comes. Whether it will go away completely, I don't know. And whether it comes back again next year, I don't know. I suspect it will come back next winter, but I don't know for certain. And the reasons for this, there are many reasons for this, and we don't totally know why this is the case, but things like during the summer, schools are out, school holidays. During the summer, it's warmer. People spend more of their time outdoors and less of their time cramped indoors with the windows with lots of people around them. And because they, take their leisure activities out of doors rather than indoors in the summer. So, and both of those are reasonable explanations for that. But that again, whether this indeed happens with this or not, we will have to wait and see. But I suspect it will decline. My guess is it will decline in the summer to and then perhaps appear again November, December.
The last thing I'd really like to cover with you, since you've got some limited time today, is around misinformation and the costs of misinformation on public health, which I think some of your research has suggested it could be deadly.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah. I mean, we published a couple of papers on this, actually, and it's quite funny. We wanted to do a bigger research project, but we didn't get the funding to support this. And so what we did is we did a couple of small trial papers. So, you know, we thought, well, we'll do what we can do in the time that we've got available, and we'll publish them. And okay, it's not going to be that, they won't be necessarily be that well taken up, but you know, at least we've flagged that this is something that we're interested in. And by chance, the last of the two was published about a week or so ago, after 2 days after the Director General of the World Health Organization complained about misinformation. Our study was theoretical, but we were using data that was available in the literature. For example, in the West African Ebola epidemic, there was a study that showed that if you believed in the conspiracy theories about Ebola, then you were less likely to undertake safe funeral practices, and therefore you were more likely to catch Ebola and die. So, yeah, these things can have and do have serious, you know, misinformation about what you need to do or not need to do can have serious implications on people increasing their risk of infection. And, there has, I gather, been a lot of misinformation around this particular epidemic, some suggesting that it's all, you know, to do with it's a genetically engineered virus or whatever. And, you know, and we don't need any of these explanations to fully describe what it is. And it only distracts from the real work of actually trying to, at best, it distracts from the real work of trying to control the virus. And at worst, it can actually facilitate further spread and therefore increase deaths around the world.
I think there are probably many examples of this. And I think one of them dealt with measles death. One of the concerns that I had read about was that misinformation around measles, vaccines of measles.
Oh, yes. Well, indeed. I mean, God, that's well known. And it is a tragedy that, you know, even now there are children in Europe and North America who die each year because their parents believed fake evidence and fake science that they found on the internet and didn't have their children vaccinated.
Yes, so this is something that is, of course, a problem with the internet today, mm-hmm. more than ever before, which is something that we will all have to deal with. Well, I thank you so much for being with us, Paul Hunter. It's been a great pleasure having you with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thank you for sharing your research.
My pleasure. It's been lovely talking to you as well. Have a good day.
You too.